Hello, and welcome to the first quarter 2020 market update conference call. My name is Michelle, and I will be your operator for today's conference. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the call over to Mr. Paul Lonergan. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you very much, Michelle. Before starting the call, I want to apologize for the delay. It's just difficult for everyone to call in at the same time, so we want to give everyone the chance to join us live, and we think that that's what we have right now. I want to remind all the participants on the call that we'll be making forward-looking statements that involve various risks and uncertainties. We will use words such as believe, expect, anticipate, will, intend, and the like. We are identifying and making forward-looking statements. Any forward-looking statements made during this presentation are subject to the safe harbor provisions of the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995. All participants on the call are invited to review CWM's Form ADV, which is available at www.sec.gov, as well as on the Congress Wealth website. So good morning to our community. I think the most important thing we would say is we all hope that everyone is healthy, your families are healthy, and everyone's in a safe place. We are currently working remotely at Congress Wealth, and that seems to be working very, very well. We have a disaster recovery plan, which we did not need to enact. We have a business continuity plan, which we did not need to enact. And the work that the team has done, led by Rich Viliotti in the last couple of years on technology, really allows us to be remote. It's not the optimal way that I would like to do business or work with clients or advise people, but it has been effective. And hopefully you have felt our outreach and our care and concern about you financially and, of course, health-wise. We ended the quarter as a company in a very strong financial position, which is important because we need to be able to move on and move through this as we are currently doing. And before I turn the call over to Rich Barrett and Ken Zanoni, the format is going to be no Q&A, just because we have so many people that have called in. I think we had 170 at the last measurement, 150, excuse me, and more people I can see calling in as we speak, that we fielded a number of questions from the audience ahead of time, and Ken is going to run through those questions at the conclusion of Rich's remarks. So, Rich, you've been our tireless champion through this process, so we'd like to hear from you. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Paul. And thanks, everybody, for joining us this morning on the call. I'd like to echo Paul's comment about, thinking about everybody in a difficult time. And as much as this call is about the economy and investment and portfolios, our business has always been about one thing, and that's people. We hope everybody, clients, friends, colleagues, family, everybody listening to the call is safe and that everybody's okay. The word you'll hear me use on this call more than any other is unprecedented, because that's what the last 3 or 4 weeks has clearly been. I'll kind of lay out a framework for my comments as talking a little bit about the crisis and the impact and kind of where we find ourselves, but I'd much rather spend most of the call kind of talking about where I see things going, a lot of the policies that have been put into place, understanding their magnitude, because it's the policy response from this, both monetary and fiscal, that's literally going to be what the market relies on as we make our way out of this crisis. So the unprecedented healthcare crisis warrants an unprecedented response, and that response has basically been to date to shut down the Western Hemisphere. Shelter in place, social distancing, quarantine, travel restrictions are all phrases none of us envisioned just a few weeks ago. Those have all translated into things like school closings and church closings and canceled big name sporting events. In the economy, it's had an immediate and negative impact. We just can't send 10, 12, 15 million people home at once and not have an economic impact, but that's what's resulted. So when we look at kind of data that looks like rail car loadings, air cargo loadings, airline passenger miles, participation in public transportation, it all looks very, very negative, and it's a direct result of the response that's been purposely put in place to hopefully get us through this crisis quickly, safely. Thinking about the economy big picture, what the impact of this slowdown means on the economy is that I think in the second quarter we've immediately gone in an employment picture that looked incredibly robust to one that looks incredibly weak. Again, purposely done so, but the unemployment rate's gone from 3.7 to roughly 10%. It probably goes marginally higher from here. GDP in the second quarter, economic activity, most of that's consumer related, is probably going to fall like $2 trillion in the second quarter. I think we're going to start hearing in the months to come about bankruptcies in some highly levered sectors, very specific highly levered sectors. The first is going to be in traditional retail and the places that houses traditional retail. That's commercial real estate, shopping mall REITs. It's also in CCC rated lower quality energy companies. These are companies that were 6, 7, 8 times levered heading into this crisis, right now have no access to capital. Those are the two areas that I think market participants should think about when they think about, you know, what could potentially have permanent loss. Our exposure as a firm here to these areas is someplace between very, 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 very negligible and de minimis, meaning like incredibly small exposures, incredibly small. We didn't own a lot of high-yield bonds heading into this. We didn't have a lot of shopping mall exposure. But as we think about like differentiating between permanent loss and temporary loss, I think it's important to be like, where are the sectors that are going to go down and stay down? And I think shopping mall retail has a huge problem and will kind of forever now. And I think CCC rated energy has been a sector that we've been harping on for 3+ years now that has a problem. The other question I'm getting a lot is, does this mean we're going to technically enter a recession? I think so much has changed in a brief period of time. You know, technical definitions need to be put aside. The, you know, economists would tell you that the technical definition of a recession is 2 consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth. Well, when you shut down the Western Hemisphere, we basically put the economy purposely into a recession within days. So I think as we look around and see a lack of economic activity, a lack of employment temporarily, I think we're seeing, you know, the outfall of what's been the response to the healthcare crisis, you know, and again, unprecedented. What's also unprecedented has been the response. I don't think it can be underplayed, understated, underappreciated as to the level of policy response that has come to this situation from both a monetary and a fiscal side. I've written a lot about this the past couple of weeks, but again, much like the healthcare problem is unprecedented, the response in its nature is also unprecedented. Let's think for a second about monetary policy and the role of the Fed. The Fed's first reaction was to cut interest rates, and they've cut them 150 basis points in short order. That's great, but it takes months, if not quarters, for interest rate cuts to really have an effect and a stimulative effect on the economy. What the Fed has followed on with, however, is remarkable, dwarfs anything that they did in 2000 and 2008, 2009, in the darkest days of the financial crisis. And I'll draw kind of some circles around this. The Fed has provided the market at a minimum of $500 billion of assistance in the repo market. The repo market, without getting too technical, is the overnight funding market about how banks and other financial institutions borrow and lend from each other overnight. When a crisis like the one that we're in the midst of shows up, what happens is liquidity disappears from the system and everybody doesn't want to, each financial institution doesn't want to lend to anybody else. They keep their cards close. They keep their capital even closer. That $500 billion has actually ballooned out now to $800 billion. The Fed needs to keep the overnight financial market working fine, the institutional market, and they are providing $800 billion in support to the repo, which is enormously positive from a liquidity perspective. The second thing that they've done is they've done about $750 billion. These are massive numbers, billions of dollars, in quantitative easing. Quantitative easing, as a refresher, this is the money printing, bond buying, drive interest rate lower monetary policy that was first initiated in 2011 when the economy hit an air pocket, but they're doing QE to the tune of like $100 to $125 billion a day, and they're buying treasuries and mortgages, providing liquidity to those markets that need it. Probably the biggest thing the Fed has done, though, is they enacted an arcane rule called 13-3. 13-3 is basically a rule in the Fed's charter that allows them to do whatever they deem necessary to continue the effective financial system from working. So, and really what they've done is they've gone in and saved the commercial paper market. Commercial paper is a way that companies, corporations, the highest quality corporations in the U.S., used to fund their short-term needs, and companies are constantly rolling that over. So in periods of illiquidity, companies that needed to roll over debt would show up at the commercial paper window and find that it was closed. This has a huge implication because these are credit-worthy companies, Fortune 100 companies people should be thinking about, the most credit-worthy companies that need to have access to near-term liquidity. And what the Fed did is they stepped in and said, you don't have to go to a financial institution to find a buyer, of a lender to you. You don't need to go to a money market fund. We'll be the lender. And they've done that to the tune of $250 billion. So, I mean, I think to sum it all up, like from a monetary policy perspective, the unprecedented response of the Fed has basically been to increase the size of their balance sheet by $1.5 trillion in 2 weeks. They've done a lot. The totality of their program is about $3 trillion. The Fed's balance sheet is probably going to grow. Before the crisis, it was about $4 trillion. By the time we're done with this, it's probably going to be between $8 and $10 trillion. And more than anything else, the Fed understands that what the system needs is liquidity. People ask me, like, you know, the Fed, you know, committing the same mistakes that they did 10 or 12 years ago during the financial crisis. The answer absolutely positively is no. A lot was learned during that crisis, and those lessons learned are being implemented in policy on a magnitude we've never seen before. And the Fed stands ready to do more. So if the crisis lingers on, the healthcare portion of this crisis lingers on, if the economy needs more assistance, the Fed is absolutely positively standing and ready to do more to make sure that both institutions, money markets, and the like remain open, free, and liquid. On the fiscal response side, while there was probably a delay while both sides of the aisle figured out, you know, the details of policy, the policy response on fiscal has also been unprecedented. $2 trillion, 2.2 to be exact, trillion dollars enacted in short order. I'll run through kind of a couple of the highlights and then draw a conclusion as to where I see it going from here. Out of that program, roughly $500 billion is to increase the value of unemployment insurance that's already been put into place, and that money is flowing to states. States are the ones that control unemployment insurance. $500 billion in short order has gone into that. Roughly $500 billion is going to go directly as stimulus into households starting in the first 2 weeks of May. It depends on whether you've actually filed your taxes electronically and the Fed has direct deposit data. If that's the case, you're probably going to get a check earlier rather than later. But the people that are being targeted with that household stimulus are households that make less than $150,000. So the stimulus is going definitely at the bottom 20% of households in the U.S. There's about $350 billion, which is in small business loans. I'll talk about that in a second. And there's about $100 billion that have been given to specific industries, most notably about $60 billion that's being given in a form of both grants and loans to the airline industry to help them. The thing I want to talk about for a second is the $350 billion of small business loans. There were six financial institutions chosen as intermediaries on this. The big three are J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, and Bank of America. Bank of America went online today. I haven't checked J.P. Morgan or Citigroup. Bank of America went online at 9 o'clock. They had 10,000 applications processed online in the first hour. So there was a lot of talk in the media about how the program was going to be a failure because the system was going to crash and stuff like that. And technology is tricky, especially in moments of crisis and panic and trying to get the job done quickly and right. But the big picture on this is that those loans, that program, whether it's today or in the next couple of days, is going to be an influx of about $350 billion of capital, and that's going to go into small and medium-sized businesses. Those businesses have less than 500 employees. Those businesses are absolutely positively at the forefront of the crisis, the employment problem of part of this crisis right now, and help has been put in place to date. When you look at the $2 trillion of fiscal stimulus that's been done, between now and the end of 2020, $1.7 trillion is actually going to be executed, which is, again, remarkable, unprecedented. We've never been here before. But I think the fiscal stimulus is about to go one step further. Yesterday's employment data was discouraging, but really not a surprise when you look around and you see nobody going to work and everybody working remotely, restaurants closed, bars closed, schools closed, airports closed. I think what we're going to get on the fiscal side when they look at those numbers, which are 6 million of additional unemployment claims, is I think the Fed is, Congress is going to move quickly to provide, you know, between $1 and $2 trillion of infrastructure. One, we absolutely positively need it. Two, it's got bipartisan support on both sides of the aisle. But more importantly, three, it's I think if we went back and were like, all right, what mistake did we make back in 2011 as a country when the economy needed a boost? I think the mistake that was probably made is that we probably should have done infrastructure spending back then. Like if you're going to spend $1 to $2 trillion on something, maybe we should start thinking about getting something out of it without getting political, and that's not the point of this call. If we're going to spend, let's spend on infrastructure. Let's end up at the end of this crisis, and every crisis does end, and this one will end. But let's make sure that we have the best roads, the best bridges, the best hospitals, the best schools, the best airports, the best ports. Let's end up better at the end of the situation. And I think we're weeks away from hearing a $2 trillion infrastructure program coming up fiscal, and that will help. One question I've gotten a lot of, actually, it was last week, not this week, but last week I got a lot of, is who's doing the selling? You know, the market's going down. Who's making it go down? There's really three parts to this answer, but the first is forced selling, and that comes in the form of margin calls. The margin call activity actually spiked when the market went down by 9% on Monday, the 23rd of March. And these are people who buy stocks using leverage. It's some individuals, but more so the big ones that were made were, you know, institutional margin call players like hedge funds. Margin calls were made, and you, when a margin call happens, they call you at 2 o'clock and they give you 15 minutes notice. You call them back and you can be either, you know, like, this is what I need to sell. If you don't call them back, they sell it for you. So it's forced selling to meet a loan requirement. It's something we've never done here. It's something we've never have done here or never will do here. But the question, like, who's doing the selling? There's forced selling. On those big days where the market goes down 7, 8, 9%, it's the 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock margin call that's absolutely happening. And I actually view margin calls as being actually a healthy part of what I've called bottoming, which is once the forced selling starts, you kind of know that you're closer to the bottom than the top of a problem. The second big seller in this market is algorithmic trading. We've talked, that's computer-driven trading. These are models that look at trend, convergence, divergence models. They're all built from really smart people who go to the top schools, and the computer knows how to do one of two things. It either knows how to buy stocks in one direction or sell stocks in one direction. And in markets like this, it's selling stocks in one direction. They represent roughly 80% of the volume that's happening in the market right now, these computer-driven models. If you go back to like December of 2018, those same type of trading strategies, computer-driven trading strategies, accounted for like 90% of trading volumes. And those were the same computers that were selling in the second week of December of 18 and then buying back the same stocks 3 weeks later at higher prices only because that's what the computer's trained to do. But algorithmic trading is just a is just part of the capital markets right now. There's nothing we can do about it, but they're one of the sellers that's going on. And retail's been selling. Retail didn't sell this week. Retail, and I'm talking $2 million to $20 million portfolios. Retail actually didn't sell this week. They actually sold the beginning of last week. They actually sold about $650 billion. And interestingly, more came out of fixed income than stocks. Roughly $400 billion came out, retail sold in fixed income. Roughly $250 billion they sold in stocks. All of it went into money market funds. They sold on the days that the market's down the most, which I don't want to say is a good sign, but it might be a good sign. Like retail selling at the bottom is symptomatic of kind of what a bottoming process looks like. They actually have bought the last 4 or 5 days after the market went up Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday a week ago, but in small amounts, nothing in the magnitude. But those are the big, like who's doing the selling. We've done very little trading here. Within our strategies, we've looked for new opportunities. I talk to Dan Lagan often at Congress Asset. They're the primary provider for a lot of our equity strategies, a phenomenal 30-year track record of owning quality companies. And within those strategies, they're looking for opportunities and making changes, not wholesale changes. I'll talk about quality in a little bit. But, you know, they're looking at the margin about, you know, who do they think are going to be the winners and losers coming out of this. And so those have been some activity. The other activity that we've been doing here is we've been doing some tax loss selling, especially for clients that have come on board in the last year or so. Those are just smart things to be doing in heightened periods of volatility. The last time we did that type of activity in any big form was in December of 18. It's something that should be done in periods where the market goes down and volatility has spiked. Creating tax loss advantages are appropriate action, but we haven't done a lot of selling, broadly speaking. We haven't changed asset allocation, broadly speaking. I'll talk in a couple minutes about why I'm optimistic about the future. Trading activity here, broadly speaking, has been very, very low. We own quality and for good reason. I think as we think about crises and where we are and where we're probably headed, it's easy to get it caught up in the news flow. I, like many people on this call, have been working from home for the last 2 weeks, and I leave the TV on to CNBC or the like, and the news flow is disproportionately negative. I see it and hear it just like every client on this phone, just like our partners. It seems to be a little bit one-sided. For good reason, this is a very severe crisis. But I think when negativity goes to such an extreme level, I think we get to come back to kind of like, how do we think about portfolios? What was the thought process that went around asset allocation? Are the assets quality assets? Why continue to own these through volatile periods like this? And the first thing I'll say is this is not the first crisis that Congress Wealth has been through. Paul Lonergan and Ken Zanoni founded this firm in the absolute dire times of 2008 and 2009. And people who started with the firm there benefited from the thoughtful construction that went into buying quality assets, both fixed income and in stocks. We've been there before. We lived through the financial crisis and carried clients through there and allowed them to build out great portfolios. They've been clients for a long time. But we've also seen 2011. We kind of forget that we've gone through other periods where the market trades terribly, but they actually have happened. August and September of 2011, U.S. debt got downgraded. Market went down by almost 30% in 4 weeks. Also a period of lots of margin calls, lots of forced selling, not here, but in the marketplace. Lots of response by the Fed. The middle of 2016, Brexit, market goes down by 18% in short order. December, fourth quarter of 2018, that one was caused by Fed policy. The Fed was hiking rates, trying to fight inflation that didn't really exist. Market went down a lot. The point of my comment on that is the firm as a whole, we believe we are the stewards of your capital. We've been through other crises. We've all kind of survived them and moved forward. Unfortunately, this isn't going to be the last crisis in the markets that any of us face, but I think the type of experience and perspective that we're bringing to the situation allows our clients to look at asset allocation and understand that it's been constructed with, you know, the ability to meet their goals and needs and risk tolerance in mind. We think we are very forward-looking about asset allocation. When we sit down, whether with a new client or an existing client, we spend all of our time thinking about asset allocation. The work behind that work, we think about asset allocation and what markets are going to return over 10-year periods, not 10-day, not 10-week, 10-year periods. We use conservative estimates when we think about return possibilities. We use probably higher than average volatility assumptions. Volatility is a really hard thing to model out because it's either really low or really high. But when you enter it into some formula or talk about it, you have to use like a median. Right now we're in a period of heightened volatility. We understand that. But when we think about like asset allocation, I think it's important for clients to remember during times exactly like this, the work that was done on the front end about asset allocation, goals, needs, risk tolerance, the thoughtful plans that advisors have put together with our clients. We are very forward-looking when it comes to asset allocation and what the world is going to look like, you know, down the road. And lastly, I think I'd kind of like just want everybody to remember that if there's one word that I think is synonymous with our portfolios, it's quality. We buy quality assets, always have a big quality bias. Probably over time, it leads us to maybe not buy what's in fashion at any given point, but we believe in owning quality because quality has a funny way of always working out. And the way I think about quality is like you look at our fixed income portfolios, there hasn't been defaults in a fixed income portfolio run by Congress in 30 years. When you think about our equity port strategies, the first work that the analysts do in picking the stocks is all about earnings being translated into cash flow and what the balance sheet quality looks like. We never want to be beholden in owning a stock of having a company be a negative earnings, negative cash flow. I need to have the bond market open all the time because they need to be able to fund my business growth. That's not how we think about companies. We buy companies with, you know, far better, excellent balance sheets because, frankly, times like now just happen sometimes. And we can't have a really good business just get mirrored up with a really bad balance sheet that generally leads to a distressed situation and permanent loss. So when I think about, like, what's gone into the portfolio, it's definitely a quality bias. When you think about asset allocation, as well as the individual securities that have been picked that go into these strategies. We focus on cash flow and earnings and balance sheet strength because what right now is all about balance sheet strength. If you asked any Fortune 100 CEO what their concern is they're like, this virus is really unknown. The economy is shut down. Do I have the capital and liquidity to carry me through to the other side? And we go into thinking about that on our average investments way ahead of time. You know, I feel bad for firms who are just thinking about that, you know, phenomenon right now because they thought about it too late. But definitely, like, as our clients think about, like, what has gone into this, it's definitely a quality bias. Surrounded by negativity, I've said in one of my notes this week, I don't know which one it was that I sent out to everybody, it kind of actually becomes easy to be an optimist. With so much negativity going on. I'm not trying to underreact or overreact to the situation that we all of us on this call, are facing. As I said before, you know, today's underreaction is tomorrow's overreaction and vice versa. But, you know, I've been looking for signs of what a bottoming looks like because I think in times like this, they start to show. I think a lot of investors try to find the bottom, which is really, really hard. They try to find the price and the day and the time that the market's going to hit the absolute bottom. And in looking for that very specific thing, they miss a lot of other very positive things that are going on that are symbolic with bottoming. So I want to talk about a couple of those for a second. Some of these have come out in my emails the last couple of days. Last week, we saw a surge in real money buying. This is real capital from real firms, not short covering or anything like that. Real money buying last week, 3 days in a row, where 80% of the stocks in the S&P 500 went up, and more than 80% of the volume traded that day went into those ideas. It sounds like minutia. It's only happened two other times in the 80-year data that we've actually looked at. And both of those were symbolic of a bottoming. March of 2009, I believe the other one was in 1974, but the most notable is March of 2009. So real money buying and stepping in here on such an extreme level smells like bottoming to me. There's actually been a surge of insider buying. So insiders should be thought of on everybody on this call as this isn't, these are corporate executives, chief executive officers, chief financial officers, board members and the like, actually taking real capital and going out and making purchases of companies that they work in. So the surge in insider buying is also synonymous with moments of bottoming. It happened in March of 2009. It happened in August and September of 2011. It happened in the middle of 2016 during Brexit. It happened in December of 18. What's different this side on insider buying is that it's actually a pretty big surge. The highest recorded insider buying is a ratio of 2-1, and that took place in March of 2009. The insider buying that's going on right now that we have access to is 1.75, and I'm looking at the data that needs to come out in a couple of weeks. I think it could go or even surpass that level, but insider buying is synonymous with a bottom. And more than anything else, it's a record low level of investor sentiment. When I talk about negativity, it's manifesting itself. Bank of America does a nice study. They talk to all mutual fund managers. The survey goes out every month. It talks about bullishness and bearishness. When everybody's bullish, generally forward returns don't look too great. When everybody's bearish, the vice versa happens. The survey that B of A just sent out just came in this morning. It's at its lowest level since the second week of March 2009, which was the bottom of the financial crisis. So when we talk about negativity and big swings, it's manifesting itself in investor sentiment, very synonymous with a bottoming. Lastly for me, it's difficult in these markets to be farsighted when everybody else wants to focus on nearsighted. The market, we're all trapped at home, we're all looking at the TV, we're all focused on this, we're trying to figure out who's behind the presidential podium at any given night, what their tone looks like, whether they're slumping or slouching, whether they sound positive or negative. I guess in thinking about trying to be farsighted, crises do end. In the last 100 years in America, we've survived an economic depression and world wars, presidential assassinations, oil embargoes, terrible acts of terrorism, none of which were necessarily planned for. But over that same time period, like GDP in our country went up 100-fold. And the reason GDP went up is that our country believes in entrepreneurism, innovation, risk-taking, and hard work and grit. And that's what's always worked. That's what's always going to work. This crisis is going to have an end sooner rather than later, just like everybody else on that. That's my wish. But we're going to come out on the other side of this, stronger, better, growing once again. It's just what America does. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ken because I know we got some questions ahead of time, and I want to make sure that we have time to tackle those. Kenny?
That's great. Thanks, Rich. We did get quite a few emails that came in, several specifically related to the overseas markets, Rich, specifically diversified international, emerging markets. So given this is, not a crisis limited to the United States, it's a global crisis, do we see opportunities there? Do we see more risk there? What's our current positioning thinking about the overseas markets?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll frame it this way. Like within the construct of asset allocation, Like, we're taking long-term views, diversified international and emerging markets have been areas over the course of the last couple of years that we've added to, because our long-term view on those markets is that not only is the price attractive, but the other underlying fundamentals are attractive for the long term. It may not be attractive any particular day that we're experiencing right now, but for example, when we think about emerging markets, it's not China and Venezuela, it's not even Brazil. The big emerging markets are China and India and Mexico and South Korea. And the big picture on those represent about 83% of emerging markets. That represents roughly just under 3 billion people. And the long-term prospects of that is that there's 3 billion people that over the next coming decades are going to have an incredible emergence of a middle class, and that's going to look like a consumer that didn't exist before. So the idea of personal consumption is going to go up. Each of those markets have various attractive features to them, but when we think about adding those strategies into a broad diversified portfolio, we're thinking about the long-term prospects of what we're paying for an asset and what we think it's ultimately going to be worth down the road. These were assets also that were trading at very distressed prices way before the current crisis unfolded in front of us. It's interesting, China's, the second or 1.5, however you want to rank economies in the world and stuff like this, they went through this crisis or are still going through it, but to a lesser extent now, it certainly sounds. Their equity markets actually done reasonably well for 5 or 6 weeks. It's just nobody's talking about it because we're focused on something else. But the big picture themes are where are the people, where are the opportunities, what is the future going to look like, and what price did you pay for that asset? Those are all the things that are going to drive forward returns. And in brief periods of times like this, they may get repriced, but the ultimate opportunity I don't think has changed in any meaningful way for something that would change our mind that there's no opportunity there whatsoever. To put it another way, Fortune 100 companies based here in the U.S. that the stock is denominated in dollars do business in all of these businesses, all these countries, every single day. And I don't see any of those companies, pulling out and saying, China or India or Mexico or South Korea is never going to grow again. I would kind of just anecdotally think about it maybe that way.
Okay. That's helpful, Rich. Rich, speaking of distress, so what about, are there asset classes out there that have been hit abnormally harder than other areas, specifically as it relates to things that generate income? Is it too early to start looking for opportunities, the things that have come down in value so much irrationally?
That's a good question. I'll frame it this way. The high-yield bond market, which is something we've stayed away from, let me take a step back. When I start talking about high-yield bonds, they have a risk-free rate, which is that they all have a coupon on them. And so they get the risk-free rate, which is the treasury rate, and then there's a credit spread beyond that that just is determined whether you're a company X, Y, or Z and what your credit worthiness is. So when I talk about attractiveness, it's based on credit spreads. The lower the credit spread, the better the credit is. The higher it is, the more risk it's involved. So high-yield debt in the last couple of weeks has emerged as an opportunity that I think is pretty interesting. We haven't done anything in the space yet, but I'll just kind of draw some context around it. In the last 2 weeks, the average high-yield bond had a credit spread of 400 basis points. Today, it's about 1,000. In 2008, it took 350 trading days to go from 400 to 1,000. This time it took 9. So the high yield market, the point of this is, as credit spreads go up, the price of the asset goes down. High yield's been an area that we've avoided But I think it's starting to emerge as an opportunity where I think there's going to be permanent loss. I think you got to be selective. And that's where we're doing some work now, because within high yield lies, you know, various forms of the two things that I mentioned before, which are areas that I think have permanent loss characteristics. Those are shopping malls as well as, you know, triple C rated, very, very highly levered energy companies. And so I think those are, you know, when I think about high yield, we're doing more work on it now than I have in the 3.5 years that I've been at Congress. It's been an area that we've avoided. But to answer the good question, it's like that's where, like, the high-yield bond market's already priced out a scenario where defaults in that market have gone to 10%. That might be true, but I think that 10% is going to be really concentrated in two areas. So if we can find a way to actually express that and avoid the areas that I think is going to be permanent loss, I think it's a way to not just get price appreciation, but also enhance income in portfolios. So you're going to be hearing me more and more bullish on high yield for the first time in 3 years, because the price has gone down a tremendous amount in a very short period of time.
Got it. That's perfect. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Paul for final comments as we approach the top of the noon hour here.
Thanks, and thank you, Rich. But more importantly, I want to thank all of our employees for being so engaged over the last number of weeks and supporting our clients, and also to our clients and friends, the deep appreciation we have for your business and the trust that you've placed in us. I like this theme of nearsighted and farsighted, and there are a number of things going on the business side that are opportunistic. We're looking at a private real estate fund that will be distressed. Ken has worked with the venture capital group to get an exclusive agreement with them where we would look at some of their strategies. So there is good news underneath this, and we all have to hang in there and get through it together. But thanks for your time today. And last point I would make is I received a couple of emails that people were struggling to get into the call because so many people called in, and I think we started at around 11:10. So the call will be recorded. It will be on our website. And until we speak again, feel free to reach out to your advisor, reach out to me, any of the management team, any of the leadership group here, and stay safe. Thank you, and have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's teleconference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.